The history of the period between the First and Second World Wars reads like a tragedy, moving from the horror of war to an idealistic hope for lasting peace, before descending into cataclysm. Today's guests seize on one of the most idealistic moments in that history, the diplomacy to outlaw war, and argue that its importance far exceeds the respect given to it by most historians. They are Ona Hathaway and Scott Shapiro, this week on Story in the Public Square. Welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. Alongside me, as always, is my friend and co-host G. Wayne Miller from the Providence Journal. Each week, we sit down with guests telling stories that matter and who can shine a light on the stories shaping American public life. Today, we're joined by two talented scholars. Ona Hathaway is the Gerard C. and Bernice Latrobe Smith Professor of International Law at Yale Law School. Scott Shapiro is the Charles F. Southmade Professor of Law and Professor of Philosophy at Yale Law School. And together, they are co-authors of a compelling new history, The Internationalists. Ona and Scott, thank you so much for being with us. The book is wonderful, and as a PhD in history, I found myself reliving the interwar period and my comprehensive exams in particular. But give us a sense of what The Internationalists is about. Ona, let's start with you.
Yeah, well, The Internationalists is a book about a moment in time when the world transformed. It's August 27, 1928. The nations of the world gathered together to outlaw war. And most people who think of this moment, mostly they've forgotten it, but to the extent that they remember it, they think of it as kind of an absurd moment in history. The idea that states would gather together to outlaw war seems inherently ridiculous, particularly given that World War II breaks out not long after. But in the book, we try to argue that, in fact, this was a monumental moment in modern history, that it transformed the world, it transformed the way that states interact with one another. And we can't really understand the system we live within today without understanding that change.
So we want to get into some of these intricacies in a minute, but Scott, why this book? What led the two of you to collaborate, and why write this book?
Well, Ona and I had collaborated previously on a project of how is international law enforced. The problem is that the world doesn't have a police force, it doesn't have a Supreme Court of the world, and yet international law, though not perfectly followed, is followed most of the time. We were wondering why that was the case. And that led us to investigate the history of the enforcement of international law. And to our great surprise, we discovered that not that long ago, the main way in which international law was enforced was through war. Mm-hmm. And then we were curious, how did that work, and when did it change? And that led us to this moment, August 27, 1928, as Ona mentioned, where the world got together and outlawed war.
So the book draws a contrast between an old world order in which aggression by states and territorial expansion through armed conflict were considered normal behaviors, and a new world order in which armed aggression was banned. Can you describe first the old world order, and then second the new world order, as you outline in your book?
Yeah. So we normally think today of war as being the consummate breakdown of the system. Before 1928, in what we call the old world order, war was the system. War was the way in which states enforced rights against one another. If one state had wronged another, the wrong state could demand reparations and, as a last resort, had the legal right to go to war. And because it had the legal right to go to war, international law in the old world order granted states many other rights as well. So, for example, states had the legal right of conquest. they had the right to use force, seize territory, and keep it. So, for example, when the United States was owed money by Mexico in the 1840s, it went to war, Mexican-American War, and conquered 500,000 square miles of Mexican territory in satisfaction of the debt. Mm-hmm. And this was not the behavior of a rogue imperialist power, but rather the way in which states dealt with each other when they had wrongs that they needed right.
Was that an order that dated back even further than that period? I mean, how far back can we take that back to antiquity? Or
yeah, so the classical writers generally talk about the right of conquest being among the most ancient of rights. It certainly extends. You know, the Bible talks about the conquest, let's say, of the land of Israel. Rome engaged in a massive conquest of the world. Our book starts, though, in the early modern period, in 1603, when the classical formulation of the Old World Order was developed by a Dutch lawyer and philosopher named Hugo Grotius, who is now considered the father of international law.
So the breakpoint, Ona, in so much of this, always comes to the early 20th century, in the period between the great wars, right, World War I and World War II. You zero in particularly on the Kellogg-Briand Pact. Tell us a little bit about that international agreement.
Yeah, so this is an agreement, as we mentioned earlier, where all the nations of the world agreed to outlaw war. And in the first part of the book, we tell the story of the Old World Order and how dependent the world was on war as a tool for resolving disputes between states. And once you see that, you see how monumental this moment, this decision to outlaw war was in 1928, because they'd relied on war for hundreds of years to resolve disputes. And now all of a sudden, they're giving that up. And it's not a very long treaty. It's very short. In fact, it fit on a postcard, so it didn't say a whole lot. It didn't really work out all the details. And in fact, that was part of the problem. They hadn't really thought through what would come next. So they decided to give up the right to use war to resolve their disputes. But they didn't really think through, well, we can't do conquest anymore. What are we going to do instead? We can't collect debts through using war. What are we going to do instead? So they hadn't really thought through the full implications. And so that's part of what's interesting, too, is that this moment is really important. But it's important because it set something in motion, not because all of a sudden the whole world transformed and we have the system we have today, you know, kind of came into being immediately. It's that they rejected the old system, and then they had to do the very hard work of figuring out how to put a new system into place.
With all those centuries of history with the old world order, what gave anyone any reason to believe that a pact, a treaty, would change things? I mean, it's only, as you said, it's words on a piece of paper.
That's a good question.
Yeah, it's a really good question. And you know, they were hard-headed politicians. So these were not sort of dreamers and idealists who are signing these treaties. These are men, in many cases, who'd been through war, who'd fought themselves in war, and you know, they were not people who you would think would just sort of come up with this crazy idea, and I think they thought that it was possible, in part because they'd been through the horrors of World War I. They had experienced how horrific that had been. They understood they all were trying to seek a way to avoid being back in the midst of that horror again. And they thought that this would be a piece of the puzzle. It wouldn't be the only thing, but that this was a part of how they would put together a new system, that they would all agree that they would renounce war. And then they had the League of Nations already in place, so I think they thought that that would play some of the role without really thinking through the fact that actually the pact and the League didn't really make sense together. So, you know, I think part of the story that's so interesting is they didn't fully think it through, but they did, in fact, believe that the pact was going to make a difference, and they all joined it, they celebrated it.
And when you say they all joined it, it's the United States, it's Germany, it's Japan, it's the United Kingdom, it's France, it's...
Yeah.
all the major powers in more than 50 others, is that?
Yeah, nearly 60 states. I mean, basically every state in the world that was engaged in international diplomacy ratified the pact within a year. So it was remarkable how widely it was agreed.
So the conventional wisdom, the sort of the book that I learned about Kellogg-Briand in graduate school, was that this was just sort of a spasm of idealism that had no mechanism for enforcement. How do you enforce not going to war? The State Department, the official State Department historian's office says, in the end, the Kellogg-Briand Pact did little to prevent World War II or any of the conflicts that followed. Its legacy remains as a statement of the idealism expressed by advocates for peace in the interwar period.
Yeah.
You take exception to that, right? Yeah. Scott, respond to sort of that conventional wisdom about the pact.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think one explanation is that the pact is a victim of its own success. That is, we take it for granted that it's absolutely barbaric to use war to enforce rights against other states. And that is, in many parts, the legacy of the pact. That is, we live in a post-1928 world where it's kind of unimaginable to behave in the way that was routinely engaged in before and for centuries. That's one reason. Another reason, I think, is that, as Ona mentioned, they didn't think through what it would mean to take away the main mechanism for resolving disputes. You can think of it as the right to wage war is like the linchpin of the old world order, and they take that out and everything else falls apart. And it takes them a good roughly 20 years to figure out, if not war, then what? What will take its place?
20 years takes you through the Second World War and the peacemaking that follows that.
So I'm a student of American journalism. What kind of coverage did the pact get at that time in the press?
It was the most covered story.
It was a front page?
Yeah, most covered story in 1928. And for the book, actually, we went through all the papers, all the Anglophone papers, Japanese papers,
really?
French papers.
Wow, that's tremendous.
Yeah.
What about the New York Times? I'm guessing they played it on the front page.
Oh yeah, for numerous days.
Wow, we'll have to look that up.
There's a line in Hamlet that I'm probably not going to get right, but it's Hamlet's thinking about what's he going to do about Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, and he says, "You cannot take that which I cannot give, except my life." Right. Mm-hmm. So, is it idealistic? Is it naive to think you can ever outlaw war?
Well, so part of what is interesting is, you know, so it seems idealistic and naive, and that's the usual story about the Kellogg-Briand Pact, as you read, you know, this kind of idealistic, ridiculous thing. But what we saw when you look back and you see what unfolds next, in fact, things do change. It takes them some time to figure out how to make this promise a reality, but they do figure it out. So Japan invades Manchuria in 1931. Japan has ratified the pact, and it seems like they're just, you know, the whole pact is worthless. You know, what's the point? They ratified the pact, they're invading. What are we going to do? How do we respond? And the world is kind of flummoxed initially because they don't, you know, they've just agreed to outlaw war. They can't really use war to enforce the prohibition on war, so what do they do? And so what they come up with is a very clever solution. Henry Stimson, who's the U.S. Secretary of State, who happens to be friends with one of the key figures in our story, Salmon Levinson, who's really the guy who came up with this idea of outlawing war, they've been engaging in this correspondence, and Levinson suggested to him, well, there's this idea of sanctions of peace, and what the sanctions of peace are is what you should do is refuse to recognize that the conquest gives any legal rights in the territory, so that Japan may take the territory, but they don't actually get to use it. We're not going to recognize it. They can't sell any of the goods. We're not going to recognize any of the marriages. We're not going to recognize stamps that are issued from that area. We're not going to recognize passports. And they come up with this idea for the first time, really, in human history, of non-recognition of conquest. And that sets in motion a whole set of changes that then produce real transformation in the world that leads us to a world today where conquest is quite rare. Whereas conquest used to be quite common before 1928, the average state could expect to suffer a conquest roughly once in a human lifetime. In the modern era, conquest, the average state can expect to suffer a conquest roughly once or twice in a millennium. Wow. So the numbers have changed dramatically, and that's because of this transformation. At least that's what we argue.
We need to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. You can listen to this episode three times every weekend on SiriusXM Satellite Radio's popular Politics of the United States. That's the POTUS Channel 124. Story in the Public Square is produced each week by a remarkably talented crew at Rhode Island PBS. And Wayne and I are both grateful to be working with them. I'm Jim Lutis, the Executive Director of the Pell Center for International Relations and Public Policy at Salve Regina University. If you want to catch up with me on Twitter, I'm at JM Lutis. As always, I'm joined by my friend and partner, G. Wayne Miller, is an accomplished author and an award-winning journalist with the Providence Journal. He's on Twitter, too, at G. Wayne Miller, all one word. And our guests this week are law professors at Yale University and authors of a new book, The Internationalists. Ona Hathaway is on Twitter at Ona Hathaway. That's spelled O-O-N-A-H-A-T-H-A-W-A-Y. And her co-author is Scott Shapiro. He's at Scott J. Shapiro. That's Scott with two T's. Ona, I want to pick up on something you just said there. Sanctions of peace, you talk about refusing the right to recognize conquest. So in the last couple of years, we've had Russia invade and seize and annex Crimea from Ukraine. The Obama administration, if I remember my history correctly here, essentially chose not to recognize that conquest and imposed economic sanctions on Russia because of that conquest. Is this a legacy of Kellogg-Briand?
Yes, it is. Exactly. It is. It is the direct consequence of the Kellogg-Briand Pact and the Stimson Doctrine that was developed relying on the Kellogg-Briand Pact. And what you see is not only does the United States not recognize Crimea as part of Russia, very few states, there's maybe two or three states that have ratified, that have acknowledged that Crimea is part of Russia. Basically, everybody else refuses to recognize it. And sanctions have been extraordinarily severe. So not just, again, the United States, but all of the EU, and which does a lot more business with Russia, has also put in place quite substantial sanctions against Russia. So they've paid a real price. The economy has definitely suffered because of this. And that's a direct result of the Kellogg-Briand Pact.
So the last great power conflict, of course, was the Second World War. What role has the advent of nuclear weapons played in the time since then, in which we have not seen certainly anything of that nature or magnitude? The threat of nuclear annihilation, nuclear Armageddon, whatever you want to call it, a real threat and risk.
Absolutely, the so-called long peace, the fact that Europe has not experienced a great power conflict is undoubtedly a result of, on the one hand, nuclear weapons and the creation of NATO. So we don't want to deny that nuclear weapons and defensive alliances like NATO make a big difference in terms of making certain types of conflict less prevalent. What we want to add to that explanation is that, first of all, only 9 countries in the world have nuclear weapons. And so it doesn't explain how non-nuclear states, why they don't go to war. It doesn't explain why the United States doesn't conquer Mexico, for example. Now, that may seem like a crazy idea, like why would the United States conquer Mexico, except that we did conquer Mexico.
Except
that it actually happened. The point that we make is that explanations like the nuclear peace, that nuclear weapons are responsible for the decline of war, leave out a crucial idea, which is that nuclear weapons are used to enforce the prohibition against war, that they're only threatened for defensive purposes. They are never used to threaten offensive action, like collecting debts or enforcing treaties, which is the way in which conventional weapons were always used before 1928.
So you describe in the book, you describe among the sanctions of peace, something called outcasting. Is it more than just economic sanctions? What is outcasting?
So the basic idea of outcasting, and this is really where our work began, was thinking this through, is that the main way in which international law works is by creating collective benefits for the states that join into international agreements and then refusing the benefits to states that behave badly. And part of that is economic sanctions. So good example is the World Trade Organization. Mm-hmm. States join the World Trade Organization, if they break the rules and they're found to have broken the rules, you don't send in the UN Army. What you do is you say, okay, you broke the rules and you're now going to lose some of the protections of the treaty equivalent to the amount that you hurt the other state illegally. So that's outcasting. You're going to lose some of the benefits. But it's true of like the International Coffee Organization. You know, you don't get to be part of the collective organization that buys and sells coffee and shares information. So it's true of lots of things.
You can even think of it sort of on a social level, right? Individuals can think of what it means to be outcast from your group or your clique, right? It's punishing.
Yes, it's a universal human sanction, right? And in fact, our early work, there's not very much about this in the book, but looks at early Icelandic use of outcasting as a way of enforcing the law. They didn't have any police, they didn't have any courts, but what they did is if you were found to be in violation of the law in medieval Iceland, you basically were outcast from the community. Nobody could shelter you, nobody could give you food, you had to leave. Not only that, but you also didn't have any protections of the law. You were not legally protected from being murdered. Right? So that was a very effective law enforcement scheme, even though they didn't have courts and they didn't have police and they didn't have any of the things we think of as being important to law enforcement.
I want to abuse my privilege here for 1 second, Wayne. But so in the case then of outcasting, which I had not thought of it in those terms before, how much patience do you have to have with an intransigent actor like Russia? Thinking again of the Crimea case, how long do they, the American society, we want quick response, we're going to take an action, there's an effect, and wow, policy was successful. How do you get to a point where the pain and the cost of outcasting is sufficient that you're going to actually change an intransigent actor's behavior?
I think that's a really important point. Outcasting techniques are often kind of slower to work. They're not flashy, generally.
No shock and awe, right?
There's no shock and awe. Yeah. There's no things blowing up. Yeah. And they can take time. I mean, occasionally they're actually fairly quick. You know, when Europe threatened to put in place economic sanctions on presidential swing states, when the U.S. Was found in violation of the WTO's rules on steel tariffs, mm-hmm. those changed pretty quickly. But it does often take time. You know, so the Iran nuclear deal was a result of outcasting over the course of more than a decade. And it finally brought Iran to the table to try and come up with a deal to give up their nuclear weapons in return for economic sanctions relief. And that took some time. And sanctions do often take more time than military intervention, but they also can be more effective.
But it seems like the central ingredient there is the will of leaders in the outcasting states to impose that cost.
Yes.
Over time.
And the thing that's important about outcasting is it can hurt both sides, right? Mm-hmm. So that is a cost on both sides. And so it does take some political will and some willingness to stick to the rules and stick to the system for a while.
So you write about the threat to the new world order created by the Islamic State, or ISIS. Talk about that. What is the nature of that threat, and how do we, how does the world counter that?
Right. So one of the things that we tried to understand when we were writing this book, which we were starting to get to the end of the book in 2014, when the Islamic State emerged as a very powerful threat in the Middle East, to try to understand what were they motivated by, what was their ideology. They had engaged in a lot of brutality, atrocities, but what were they after? And in the book, what we argue is that what ISIS really is after is a rejection not just of Western or American imperialism in the region, but rather the international system that was created in the wake of 1928 and 1945. That is, from the radical Islamic point of view that the that ISIS adopted and has adopted, man-made borders of sovereign states, to recognize those borders is to recognize that man has the right to legislate for other men and for other people, and that this is a violation of the dictum that only God has the power to legislate for humankind. And so the threat that ISIS poses is that it wants to get rid of the modern system of sovereign states. And what we ought not to do is win that war for them. That is, we ought not to violate the rules that were put in place after 1928 in order to defeat them, because that would actually be granting them victory.
Ona Hathaway, Scott Shapiro, the book is The Internationalists, and it's wonderful. Thank you so much for being with us today. That's all the time we have today, but if you want to learn more about Storing the Public Square, you can visit us on pellcenter.org, where you can catch up on previous episodes, or you can always find us on Facebook and Twitter. He's Wayne, I'm Jim. We hope you'll join us again next time for more Storing the Public Square.